Well, I want to thank the Biosafety Alliance for inviting me here today. I almost didn't make it, but I'm very glad I did. I want to start off talking about a little anecdote, because I'm going to talk about resistance and transformation. I'm going to talk about construction and protest, civil disobedience, transforming the food system through alliances for change. I was a professor once, and I worked with Boston University, and we had this crazy program that went around the world with seniors, 30 seniors and three professors. And we stopped one time in the Philippines, and we went to the International Rice Research Institute, which is one of the centers of the CGIAR system, the Centers for International Agricultural Research. These are the centers of the Green Revolution that produced the high-yielding or high-consuming varieties that supposedly saved 1 billion people from hunger, which we're finding out isn't true, but that's another story. So we were at IRI, it's called, the International Rice Research Institute, and since these were my students, they were peppering the researchers there with all kinds of very uncomfortable and difficult questions. And we ended up down in the seed vault in the refrigerator. It's a huge, huge refrigerator. You imagine how much that costs to run in the Philippines, in the tropics, full of thousands of varieties of rice that the Centers for International Agricultural Research had basically pirated from all across Asia and now held in the seed bank in the interests of humanity. And so my students, of course, began to ask the man there, the professor, well, the scientist there, well, you know, you've got all the seeds here, but in fact, while the Philippines used to grow something like 2,000 varieties of rice, now there are only 4. And all the rest are sitting here in the seed bank. You know, how is that sustainable? And then questions like, well, you know, all these seeds, it's not just the genetic information that's important. What about all the knowledge about how to grow these seeds and the agroecosystems and the polycultures and the different management practices that these different seeds are appropriate to and the different diets and cuisines and climates and on and on? And what about all that knowledge? Where is that? And, of course, the scientists found all these very difficult to answer. So when the students left, I stayed on sort of out of collegial deference, because I wanted to bring my students back there again the following year, because I thought it was so instructive. And the guy and I started to talk, and it turned out that this man had been in on the ground floor of this seed bank. And this had been his career at the International Rice Research Institute. And he confessed to me with tears in his eyes. He said, Professor, these seeds are rotting. They're rotting. We're losing these seeds. Why? Because you have to plant these seeds out. You can't just let them sit in the refrigerator. You've got to plant them out. You've got to harvest them again. Then you've got to put fresh seeds back in. You can't just... So next time you hear about the Doomsday Vault up in the Arctic, you know, I think that's Carrie Fowler's folly. Right? This isn't a good backup system for our agrobiodiversity, for our genetic diversity. But I tell this story because I think it really encapsulates the challenge which we face today. Because seeds, in fact, were the first building blocks of today's corporate food regime. I think of a corporate food regime as all of the institutions and all of the rules which govern our food system. There have been three regimes through history. We're in the corporate food regime now. Think of the World Bank as one of the institutions. The IMF is one of the institutions. Think of the Farm Bill as part of the rules which govern our food system. Think of all the monopolies from Monsanto to Walmart as the institutions which govern the corporate food regime. Anyway, this food regime was painstakingly built, beginning with seeds, beginning with the biopiracy, with the stealing of the seeds from the peasantry around the world, stashing them in gene banks, and then making commercial hybrids. Now, for a time, these seeds were in the public realm. They're not in the public realm anymore. But that was the first step in creating a food system, this corporate food regime that we have today, in which we have a billion stuffed and a billion starved around the world. We produce over 1.5 times enough food to feed every man, woman, and child on the planet, yet we have a billion hungry people. Most of those hungry people are farmers. A good 70% of those hungry people are farmers. Most of those farmers are women, and they produce half of the food in the world, and yet they're going hungry. So there's clearly something wrong with this system. This system has brought about the great agri-food monopolies. We have monopolies that roam the earth now like huge dinosaurs like we've never seen before, like Monsanto and Walmart, Tesco, Carrefour, who basically control our food system from farm, from the seed all the way to the fork. They've brought us a tremendous series of crises. So first we have the food crisis, we have the fuel crisis, we have the climate crisis, we have the financial crisis, and these are all interrelated. And they're all driven by what I think Don was alluding to, which is a crisis of capital accumulation. If you look over the world for the last just 15 years, I looked and saw how, in Forbes about 15 years ago, how many billionaires did we have? Well, we had about 500 billionaires. Now, how many we have now? Close to 2,000 billionaires. World economic growth has been flat. That means there's been a tremendous concentration of wealth. Now, what are these people going to do with their wealth? You know, if I'm a bank and you all put money in me, I'm happy for about 10 minutes or 10 seconds. And then I've got to move and reinvest this money, as Don pointed out, because I got to pay you interest. Right? I can't just sit on this accumulated wealth. Well, neither can these monopolies. They've got to reinvest. They're forced to reinvest. So where would Monsanto reinvest? They've saturated the markets in the United States. They've saturated the markets in Latin America. Europe doesn't want to let them in. Where can a monopoly go? Where are they going to go? To Africa and save the world from hunger? Because it turns out the only part of the world, of the global economy which is growing, is what the economists call the base of the pyramid, the poor. They're growing at about 8% a year. Now, they're not getting any richer, but they're growing because there are more and more poor. So that's a market. Well, you can't sell them iPads. But since most of the poor happen to be farmers, you can sell them seeds. But to do that, first you have to take their seeds away and then sell them back. And in order to rationalize that, you have to convince everybody that you're saving them. You're saving them from hunger, and we're going to produce more, and we're going to deal with climate change. Well, there have been studies that basic international studies, like the ISTAT, which basically show this is a bunch of crocks. This is a crock. I won't finish the sentence. This is a big crock. That's not true. You can't possibly produce enough GMOs to deal with climate change. Right? And you can't produce them fast enough. What can you do? Well, you can do what farmers have been doing for nearly 10,000 years, since the Neolithic, which is you modify the agroecosystem. And that, in fact, is where our biodiversity resides, with the peasantry. You might think the peasantry is disappearing. We have as many peasants now as we had 500 years ago. We've got about a billion and a half peasants in the world. Because we have de-peasantization, but we have re-peasantization. People stay on the land. They go back to the land. There's nowhere else to go. The world economy is flat. People are going back to the countryside because they have no choice. It's not like it's a nice place to live. But what do? They manage our agrobiodiversity in vivo, not in vitro, where it's static and it rots. They manage it in vivo, in the fields, where it's dynamic and always developing, and where you don't lose the diversity and you don't lose the knowledge. So I would say that family farms and the type of public programs that Brooke was talking about for research, seed research, and the world's peasantry are in fact our bulwark against the corporate food regime. But that means we have to form alliances, because otherwise we're going to lose the peasantry. And if we lose the peasantry, we lose our dynamic agrobiodiversity. And when GMOs crash, and they're already crashing, just take a drive through the southwest of this country and see all the pigweed, and you know they're crashing, right? Where are we going to go? You're not going to be able to go to the seed banks. You're not going to be able to go to the doomsday vault. You're not going to be able to go to the CGIR because those are privately held. They'll sell you those seeds at a high price. Where are we going to go for our seeds? Where are we going to go for our biodiversity? Where are we going to go for the knowledge? It's the peasantry. It's the small farmers of the world. Small farms are the fastest growing sector in farming in the United States. Not terribly viable. This market economy isn't working for anybody. We need good public policies as well. So how do we get there? We've got to form alliances. We have to, on the one hand, construct new food systems, integrated food systems for people on the economic principles that Don was talking about. And we have to resist. We have to protest. We have to break these laws. You know, when the farmer was taken all the way to the Supreme Court here, and people said, oh, yeah, but, you know, it's a Monsanto-friendly Supreme Court. They're going to rule against him. And, of course, they did. It wasn't the problem of, of the confirmation of the Supreme Court. The problem was the law of patenting life. The Supreme Court was completely coherent in their decision, given the law. They ruled against the farmer, ruled in favor of Monsanto. Their law is wrong. We have to break that law. That's how you change laws, either with money or disobedience. That's how it's changed through history. So we have to build a very strong social movement which can challenge the strongest players in the corporate food regime, and Monsanto is one of them. And I would say that seeds are a bridge. They're a bridge which bring together different actors from rural and urban sectors. They bring together radical actors who want to change the rules, with progressive actors who want to change the practices, to form a strong social movement capable of ushering in reforms. Because reformists don't bring us reforms. They're not strong enough. They never have been. Roosevelt was a reformist. He wasn't able to bring the New Deal without all of the tremendous power of the social movements which were in the streets during the Great Depression, willing to break laws, willing to push for change. The strong labor unions we had at the time. Right? We have to build a broad-based social movement that powerful now if we expect to save our agrobiodiversity on this planet. If we expect to roll back the power of the corporate food regime, not just reform it, but transform it in a way which is sustainable and equitable and works for all of us. Thank you very much. Yeah, I'd like to respond to that. I think that you're absolutely right. You know, we've got to use the power of the pocketbook. But it's not enough. I mean, we have to change the rules. We have to reestablish our public sector, for example. Because if you go out and you try to buy organic seed as an organic farmer, there's very little organic seed to be had. So the power of your pocketbook doesn't go very far. And why is that? It's because we haven't funded research and development of organic seed. And these are things which need to be publicly funded. I mean, agriculture is a public activity through history. Since the dawn of civilization, agriculture, it's always been a public social activity which has been supported by society. So I think that we do have to vote with your fork. But we also have to realize that there's a lot of things which are simply not on the ballot. And for a lot of people around the world, there aren't any ballot boxes. In other words, they don't have enough money to be able to vote in that type of an election. So that's where I think that our buying habits and our being conscientious consumers needs also to be paired with being activists and doing what it takes to change the rules.
One more question. We got.
What are we doing in terms of big activities at Food First? I mean, well, we support this initiative in the Biosafety Alliance. I think it's very important, these types of public fora to talk about these issues and to try to organize resistance. We produce information and analysis for the social movements that the ones working for food justice and food sovereignty around the world. And we also try to amplify the voices of those who are on the front lines making these transformations and developing the alternatives, which hopefully will someday be the norm rather than the perpetual alternative. And we also work on the ground. I mean, we have urban farmer field schools in Oakland and the East Bay of San Francisco. We have a pollinator restoration project with the farmer-to-farmer movement in Central America. We work with the We Are the Solution campaign, which is a network of women's farmers organizations in Africa to roll back the New Alliance for a Green Revolution, AGRA, you know, to basically denounce and roll back Bill Gates' pet project in Africa. So we try and keep a foot in the work and also keep on publishing and producing analysis.
I think we're
done. Thank you.